It's March 19th. This is Hearing Room B. It's Senate Judiciary, and the hearing will be starting at 3 p.m. The hearing will begin with Senate Bill 176, followed by Senate Bill 226, and then there will be a work session on Senate Bill 229, Senate Bill 230, Senate Bill 231, and Senate Bill 309.
The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senators Frye and Wires are present. We'll proceed with a public hearing on Senate Bill 176. As I understand, it was carried over from last week. Also, Senate Bill 226 was carried over, and we have a witness from Portland. Let's see. We have three witnesses signed up for 176. Two from Salem, one from Portland. All three of them willing to come together? Yeah. All right. Lee, Mike, and Julie. On the Senate Bill 176. Judy McFarland?
Julie
McFarland.
She's got the hallway.
For the record, my name is Len Monks, Children's Services Division Assistant Administrator responsible for Correctional Services. And joining me at the table this afternoon are Mike Greenfield from Marion County Juvenile Court and Julie McFarland from Juvenile Rights Project. As pre-session filed, Senate Bill 176 would make escape or absconding of a student from the juvenile training school or other juvenile corrections placement a Class A misdemeanor. Our intent with this was to facilitate the arrest, detention, and ultimate return of these youth, solving two major problems that we were experiencing at present. And one has been an in-state problem with the last session passage of House Bill 2936. Many courts have applied pre-adjudicated standards to the Hillcrest McLaren youngsters who have already been adjudicated, and it's been presenting some problems in terms of timely return of youngsters to the institution. The second problem we've had with the present language is out-of-state returns of youngsters who have absconded and apprehended out-of-state. In many other states, the detention standards require an arrest or warrant number, and since in the state of Oregon it's not a crime to run away from a training school, the other states have not been able to get from us a warrant arrest number so they can hold them. And sadly, some youngsters have been released from other states. In one case, it was a youngster with a homicide background, and they simply could only hold a three-hour police hold until we got there, and it was impossible to get there in 3 hours because we couldn't get an arrest warrant number. So our solution was to draft this bill. It was pre-session drafted. Since it was drafted, we, in concert with the juvenile courts and the Juvenile Rights Project, have decided there's a better way of doing it, and so we've done that and have offered amendments to you, and it's in your materials, in a way that we can all come before you in agreement and you won't have to mediate between us. So we hope that's helpful for your committee work. And instead of making it a crime to run away, which the greatest concern is some of the constitutional issues and the concern that it would add time to the youngster's length of stay in the system, which we didn't intend by this legislation, what the amendments that we offer today do is make it possible for the superintendents of the training schools to issue an order of arrest instead of making it a crime to run away. This is modeled after our current statutes in Oregon with the Adult Corrections Division. They are able to do that, and the reference to that is ORS 144, 350, and 360. So if you want to look at the CSD proposed amendments that are before you, you will see on the first page, the top cover page, we add the definition of a student, which isn't in the 420 language. And the reason we're selecting 420 is because we're no longer talking about revising the criminal statutes. The original 176 amended 162, which is your criminal statutes, so we were approaching it differently. So in 420, what it presently allows is the training school superintendents to authorize peace officers in this state to apprehend and hold kids. It doesn't say where they can hold them, or it doesn't say for how long they can hold them. And so what we do in Section 2 of our proposed amendments is take the language of 420.910, and as you can see on the top of the second page, modeling it after the adult statutes allows the superintendent to order the arrest and detention of a student upon being informed and having reasonable grounds to believe he's escaped and absent without authorization. Also, we add to that a sentence of criteria, which is an adult statute, explaining under what circumstance we have to ascertain that. The subsection 2 is taken from ORS 144360 in the adult language, and together they present a package that has been found workable and constitutional for the Adult Corrections Division. That would allow us, where necessary, to be able to issue an order of arrest, and we anticipate this is only really needed on those out-of-state cases where they are asking us for an arrest warrant number because their state does not allow a detention unless they have that. Number 3 takes it one step further and allows us, if that isn't satisfactory to some other states, which in some cases they want a judge's signature, subsection 3 allows the juvenile court of the county from which the student was committed to McLaren to issue an arrest warrant under the same circumstance if the administrative signature isn't good enough. This would only probably come up in a rare instance where a youngster does not want to be extradited back to Oregon. We have to go through extradition procedures in which we send signed documents. That's the only time that would come up. We presently in Children's Services Division are only talking about 3 or 4 youngsters a month who are apprehended out of state. In most cases, a number over the phone will be sufficient, and so the subsection 1 and 2 procedure will be the majority of cases envisioned. Section 3 on the second page addresses the in-state problem I spoke of detention standards. All that our present statutes say in Oregon and in ORS 42915 is that when one of our McLaren and Hillcrest youngsters are apprehended, as far as practicable, which was old language, we hold them in a place separate from adult persons. So right now, in Oregon statute, we can hold juveniles in adult jails according to language that's in 420. We propose to change that and specify that under these circumstances, if the youngster is 18 or is under 18 years of age, that he'll be held in a juvenile detention facility. If the escapee from McLaren is 18 or older, he'll be held in adult detention. So there'll be that separation, which is consistent with, I think, case law and probably hopefully the thinking of this committee. So we think that makes the language better and consistent with some of the other legislation that's presented on the House side this time. Subsection 2 of that Section 3 provides a time limit because presently, again under 42915, if a McLaren or Hillcrest youngster is apprehended after escaping, there is no time limit in Oregon how long they can be held in detention before you do anything about it. They could languish. We don't do that as a practical matter, but what we have come up with is language that calls for 36 hours, that within that time we would make arrangements and get them out of that detention facility, adult or juvenile, and get them back to Hillcrest and McLaren and then get back into programming. We have determined that throughout the state, whether it's eastern Oregon or the far reaches of the southern parts of the state, this is satisfactory time to make those arrangements. So we think this strengthens the present statutes in two ways. On the third page, the amendments there simply talk about notification, that when a youngster is held in our behalf, that we have a way of being notified so we can make those arrangements within 36 hours. Subsection 4 simply says that ORS 419577, which is your normal detention criteria related to House Bill 2936 of last session, does not apply in these cases of escape. So it's just clear it's a cross-reference to that language. And that whole section 4, unfortunately we had to type 3 or 4 pages there, simply takes a present detention language, and at the very end you'll see the underlined provision cross-referencing to what you did it for with 420 if this were to pass. So I've rambled on, but I think I've covered the amendments and their purposes, and I'll answer any questions to clarify right at this point, or Mike Greenfield, the table representing juvenile courts, could give their testimony. Julie McFarland will soon be with us. Julie is here. Julie from Juvenile Rights Project also going to offer testimony. So what's your pleasure? You want to take further testimony? Do you want clarification on my presentation on behalf of CSD?
Well, in the absence of some senator raising his hand, we'll proceed with the next witness. And the record should note at 3:10 that Senators Brockman and Brown are here with us, and Senator Hamby is here. And the clerk will kindly note, so I won't have to say it, the arrival of any members of the committee, all of whom have been excused until they arrive.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
My name is Mike Greenfield. I'm the director for the Marion County Family Court. The Juvenile Court Judges and Directors Association, of course, hasn't had a chance to examine these particular amendments. However, we did, at our last meeting, endorse the concept of needing to do something with kids who were leaving those institutions, and it is my opinion that this bill certainly falls within what the association has approved, and so it's my opinion that we would be supporting this. I certainly do, and Judge Norblad supports these amendments to this bill.
Thank you. Julie McFarlane?
Julie McFarlane, Juvenile Rights Project. I did submit written testimony that I hope you received. I'm not going to go into that. It mostly talks about our objections to the original printed version of the bill, which, as Mr. Monks has already said, we've been able to work out with the amendments that have been submitted by CSD. The amendments, I think, are good and workable. They allow the committee to avoid really a morass of constitutional questions that would have arisen under the original draft of the bill, and accomplish the same purpose, which is to obtain the return of children who have escaped from the training schools. So with the CSD amendments, we would be able to support this bill.
Well, that's good. Now, did you kind of come together on this after the last hearing, or was it in place at the time the last hearing was scheduled?
It was in place at the
last
hearing.
Well, worked very well together. Any questions of the committee members? All right. Thank you very much. And I think that will conclude the public hearing then on Senate Bill 176. Turn to Senate Bill 226. Kathleen Haley, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Council.
In addition to the bill and the staff measure analysis, there's also a brochure included in the front pocket of your book that tells you a little bit about the exactly what the PSRB is, if you might like to glance at that.
Chairman Fry, Vice Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley. I'm the Executive Director for the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Senate Bill 226 consists of two main amendments to the existing statutes on the board, other than omitting the gender-based references. First, the escape statute would be amended to include persons who are on conditional release under the board and are placed outside of the state. The second is that it moves and clarifies the burden of proof on a two-year hearing. Right now, as the first part of the statute exists on escape, the escape crime is covered only if a person leaves the state under the board's jurisdiction without an authorization of the board. The second part about the clarification of the burden of proof, it simply clarifies board practice in that matter.
Okay. Questions? I'll just make an observation that I'm looking at page 2, line 7. There's a reference to the, quote, prosecuting officer. That's current law. And then the amendment on the following line uses that phrase again. On the preceding page, the term district attorney is used two or three times there. I don't know whether somebody intended the prosecuting officer to be someone other than the district attorney or not, but I've noticed in this session that we're getting frequently I see bills that are using the term prosecuting attorney or prosecuting officer or prosecutor instead of district attorney, and I'd like to say that from my point of view, I'd like to see some consistency, and I'd like to retain the term district attorney. So if there is no difference between the prosecuting officer and the district attorney in this bill here, I'm going to suggest that we make that change. Is there a difference? Or?
Well, first of all, my predecessor drafted this, and in going over it, I didn't actually pick up on that. I picked up on more of the substantive parts, but I don't see any problem with changing prosecuting officer to district attorney.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Brown.
The use of the term district attorney in the very first lines of the section and the use of the term a prosecuting officer a bit further on, of course, was done in earlier legislatures. Mm-hmm. So we can't quite blame the sponsors of the legislation.
No.
They just continued the dichotomy by repeating the term prosecuting officer in the same subsection. I'm not saying that you were blaming them, but you know, we've got, I'm sure the law is shot with these semantic difficulties,
mm-hmm.
which we inflict on ourselves.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thanks very much, Sen. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 226. And we're going to take a look at 1, 2, 3, 4 other bills. And let me find out first whether we've got any people signed up to testify on Senate Bills 229, 230. This is a work session, I'm sorry. These are bills that were discussed last week.
Mm-hmm. It's aside from 309, which is just back for
yes.
to approve a minor amendment drafting.
All right. Well, let's turn to Senate Bill 229. Yes, if you would.
All three bills that we'll be discussing, Senate Bill 229, 230, and 231, are bills that came in from the Division of State Lands. The first one, Senate Bill 229, is a bill that exempts from public records law disclosure of reports submitted by holders of abandoned property until after the notice has been given and property delivered to the Division of State Lands. You may remember last week that the reason that this was discovered or that this was presented by the Division of State Lands was because they wanted to limit the ability of air searchers, H-E-I-R searchers, to
what kind? Say that again.
H-E-I-R.
People
go out
okay.
and look
right.
for
errors.
Errors of that. It's
finders of lost love.
Mr. King.
From going out.
Which we realize we're actually owners and or heirs.
Yes, owners or heirs.
Owners or
from searching out these people before they were searched out by the Division of State Lands. A couple of things were discussed by the committee, one of them stemming from the staff measure analysis. Let me find that. Staff measure analysis pointed out two other relevant statutes that were discussed to some extent. One of them was ORS 98.372 that provides that an owner of property is not entitled to receive income or other increments which have accrued to the property after the property is paid or delivered to the division. The other one is a provision ORS 98.418 that provides that all agreements to pay compensation to recover or assist in the recovery of abandoned property are unenforceable if made within 24 months after date the property is delivered to the division. There was some discussion that last week about allowing the division some money for making an effort to find the owners of the property. There was some discussion about maybe repealing the two-year provision making the contract of air searchers unenforceable, but there was nobody really landed on anything and nobody's talked to me since then. But that's other than asking. The committee asked me to look up a question. Those basically what the committee was talking about. There was some expression by at least one committee member that this bill might look like the state was encouraging or discouraging people from finding the owners, because the longer the state got to hold on to the money, the more interest it got. Anyway, that was raised. The committee did ask me a question. They asked the money this abandoned property or money or whatever is goes to the county school fund right now, and they asked me if there was a constitutional dedication of those monies, and there is. It's under Article 8, Section 2, Subsection 1, Paragraph B, which reads, the sources of the common school fund are, B, all monies and clear proceeds of all property which may accrue to the state by a cheat or forfeiture. So, to some extent, this money and proceeds is constitutionally dedicated. So, that's basically what happened last week.
Okay.
Appropriately so.
Any questions, comments, or suggestions on Senate Bill 229?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Simmons.
I think maybe I was the one that was saying that the procedures looked as if the State Land Board was trying to be very, very greedy in depriving people of regaining the property that had been abandoned. And that by giving them the opportunity to advertise and receive claims within a reasonable time after they ran their ad, and then turning it over to the commercial air searchers or whatever they're called, that the rightful owners were being given a greater opportunity to reclaim their just property. And the present law, and I thought we might have had an amendment to delete that, which provides that the agreements to pay compensation are unenforceable if made within 24 months after the date the property is paid to the division. If enforced, would literally put these people out of business, and which I'm not as concerned with their being put out of business as I am concerned with the number of dollars that they are able to find for the rightful owners. And that if I had an heir, I mean an ancestor or an antecedent who had a lot of money on deposit somewhere, and I didn't realize it, but they found me and said, hey, you've got this money, go claim it. I would be perfectly willing to pay them a percentage to get that much more than I would have otherwise had, which would have been nothing. So I think we should encourage the air finders, and if it's a good legislative policy to put in some kind of a percentage or a minimum commission or whatever is might be appropriate, let's do that, but let's still eliminate the requirement that they can't contract to do that.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, let me ask a question to Senator Hendrickson first of Senator Simmons. In view of the existence of 98.418, whether it gets changed in form or not, is Senate Bill 229, does it do anything? I mean, is it really necessary?
Well, apparently, Mr. Chair, all that 229 does is make these records of the money, of the fact that there is a thing of value abandoned, make them confidential until such time as the agency has given public notice and the property has been delivered to them. So it prevents the commercial searcher from entering the picture until after the states had their chance to find it. And yeah. I have no quarrel with that.
Well, I understand that, but you know, but if the theory of Senate Bill 229 is to keep the commercial air finders from taking advantage here, do we really need that if they can't take advantage because under 98.418 they couldn't make a valid contract anyway?
Mr. Chairman. Sure.
Senator, 98,
Senator Simmons, go ahead.
The 98.418 is the one that I think should be repealed, which in effect eliminates them from getting any compensation at all.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
In fact, they do receive compensation because although it's not enforceable, they do enter into these contracts, and based upon the written word, the unenforceable contract, people do pay up their 25% or their one-third contingency. It seems to me that as long as we have people of the caliber who are heading up this particular branch, and I have full confidence in them, and they're willing to make an effort to find the owners and return the property to them and at no cost, at no cut, that it seems to be that in this period of time that expires before the property is delivered and maybe for 1 year thereafter, we should let them try the nonprofit low-cost endeavor to find the more obvious heirs out there. But after 1 year, we could open up these records and also open up the enforceability of the contract. So my conceptual proposal is basically that we support the proposed amendment, that maybe we even keep it confidential for 1 year, but after the passage of 1 year, that we remove the confidentiality and also we grant the enforceability of the air searcher's agreement.
Senator Hendrickson.
I got into this one quite a bit too during the original hearing, and I think one of the discrepancies in the current policy is although they have a law that says the contract is unenforceable, the Attorney General brought out that in fact it never operates because people are not aware of their rights. So I suggested that perhaps we should require some sort of notice on the contract with respect to people's rights. I think they probably perform a valuable service in terms of commercial service. I had asked, I don't know if we received it, on the percentage of money that was returned to true owners, how much of that was as a result of the efforts of these commercial enterprises. I don't know if we ever got information with respect to that, but I would think that if we're going to have a law that the contracts are unenforceable, then we need to make sure that those people that are contracting with these agencies know what the law is. Otherwise, there's no point in having the law. I'm not so sure that it's not a good law, but right now, it's just kind of a meaningless kind of law because individuals are not informed of the fact that the contracts are unenforceable.
All right. Now, before I recognize Senator Weyers, the council wanted to make a point on these reports that are submitted to the division.
Okay. One of the things that was mentioned last week is the fact that they are covering the bill. Senate Bill 2229 would make the reports that are submitted confidential between the time the report is submitted and the time the property is turned over to the state. Under current law, ORS 98-418 does not apply until the property is turned over to the state. So it's from that.
They're off the hook to that extent.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So apparently the policy is to encourage the deliveries and to relieve everybody of liability, even if it's negligent or wrongful, just to make sure everyone will deliver, the holders will deliver the property.
And I'd add again that ordinarily that's not a problem when the property remains intact and when you don't have a duplicate. When you do have a bona fide purchaser, that raises a different problem when it's not otherwise addressed.
Go ahead.
Well, as long as we've got a good risk manager, I guess we can.
Let me say for the benefit of the committee that although it may be a little bit different from the views that other committee chairs have, I feel that once you've been recognized that you can continue to ask your questions without asking additional recognition. That'll save us a little time. Okay. You'll have the floor as long as you want it, unless for some reason you get cut off by the chair, but I don't think that we need to ask recognition for every single question. You've got the floor. You go ahead and finish your line of questioning.
Oh. Well, I think I've really, my question was with the bona fide purchaser about the policy issue of having the state assume the liability. And from looking at this other statute with respect to other property, the policy seems to be that we want people, these holders, to give up this property and give it to the state. And so we're relieving them of liability if they'll do so.
For the purpose of trying to get it back to the owner.
Right. It does present a problem, though, where we can have bona fide purchasers out there. But this apparently is following the same policy, so we're doing this knowing that we are increasing the liability of the state in terms of if there are bona fide purchasers out there and the business is negligently delivering duplicate stock certificates.
Any other questions?
Wires. Well, consistent with that, are there instances where the kind of problem that Senator Huntington is worried about happening hasn't happened yet because you don't have this clarified language yet as to intangibles, or are you having?
They don't do intangibles.
They're going to do intangibles now.
Right.
So we can't ask you, have you been having any problem with this, because you haven't had it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment, we've discussed this quite lengthily at the National Association of Administrators of the various 50 states. When the Uniform Act was passed in 1981, Oregon elected in 1983, when we adopted most of the current amended versions of 98, not to include these underlying shares. Part of the problem, and as I saw it from the administrative standpoint, there wasn't much track record. And I didn't feel that Oregon needed to get in early. Since in the last 2 years, majority of the states now have adopted these underlying shares provisions. As of our last meeting that we had last December, it was discussed. It doesn't appear to have created a major problem yet, to answer Senator Weyers. But again, the track record is not very lengthy. It's not been in practice for many of the states.
Well, what are we losing by waiting a little longer? What is the downside of waiting?
The downside of waiting, Mr. Chairman, is that under the current statute, we would never get them. The only stock certificates that we now get are if there was a certificate purchased and the certificate is never delivered, or if a stock split is made and the split is never delivered. What's happening is that there are thousands and thousands of shares that have been issued to individuals, generally small shares. Grandfather got it, stuck it in the chest of drawers, and has forgotten about it. And they are unable to find these people. They're having difficulty in delivering dividends and other things. And that's the purpose of this, is to take action to get these unfound, delivered underlying shares, and then to cycle those dividends back in, instead of the companies holding them.
Mr.
Chair.
Thank you. Senator Cohen?
Yep. I guess I think we ought to proceed with allowing the division to have that tool and to try to find the appropriate people, and if not, to properly go to the common school board. And I guess until we find out that the state, that there is, people are rushing in to deliver things that are inappropriate, or that they've also sold, you know, there are duplicates out in other areas, then I guess I'd, until we get a track record of really finding a problem, I'm not sure that I know how we ought to draft that liability. And I think the first time we have a case of the administrator,
Mr. Chairman, if I might
doing
just
something, then I think we'll come in and we'll have the specifics to cope with it. But
I might just respond to clarify for a moment. I think if the situation arose where the division had some liability to a bona fide purchaser, that payment would be made. But then we'd also look back to the fact that either the division then would not have any further liability to the original owner who hadn't surfaced, or if that original owner had surfaced and claimed it, and in that case we'd have made two payments, the administrator would likely have some recourse against the original owner who received payment, knowing that he'd already transferred to a bona fide purchaser. So there is some recourse, and it's not that the state would have a double liability in all cases.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Henderson.
Well, the only thing is, though, what if if you get a duplicate stock certificate and nobody has claimed it, or nobody says they're a bona fide purchaser, you're going to want to sell it, aren't you? Mm-hmm. So you could sell it to somebody.
Yes.
And then a bona fide purchaser pops up and said, oh, but I bought the original. You know, maybe they're both claiming dividends or something. So you could, I think you could have a situation where you had two parties, and one's going to be shortchanged, and whoever got shortchanged is going to sue somebody. But I guess my feeling about it, I just think we need to understand we've created this liability. I don't feel uncomfortable necessarily with us having liability, but I think we need to know that we've created that liability. But don't you agree there could be that situation?
Well, I think in the situation that you just described, if the division had sold it, the division would have received the proceeds, and that would be on deposit. So it would be the proceeds that were then paid to the bona fide purchaser. So there would be no net loss to the state. It would just be that you don't realize the proceeds from that particular piece of property. I'm sorry, my voice is kind of fading on me here.
Okay, but Mr. Chairman, okay, right, you've got the money. The person has purchased the duplicate certificate, but then you've got, that person thinks they bought something, and you've got a bona fide purchaser on the original stock, and they think they bought something too, and so you've got two groups of people think they bought something, and two people claiming money. Now the original person is going to get it because they're the original owner. And then what happens to the bona fide purchaser who's already given the fund the money?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Mr. Brennan.
I think the problem is that what we're saying is that was a stock that was issued to a person. The holder has lost contact with him. The purchaser has sold it, but there can't be a second title in another person without going back through the transfer agent, and they would have then discovered that they've issued a duplicate certificate. So you won't wind up with two owners.
you'll have the original party that tries to present the original certificate, and it will show that that certificate was reissued in duplicate and was forwarded to the Division of State
right,
Lands.
Right, and that's when the lawsuit starts.
That, when that party then has a claim to the Division of State Lands, if we have the duplicate certificate in our possession, we'll exchange it for the original.
Right, but I'm assuming you've already sold it.
If we sell it, then we will give him the proceeds of the sale of the duplicate for the original.
See, they'd be holding the money.
See, we will be holding the money and give him then the money for the original certificate from the sale of the duplicate.
Is that what you wanted to say, Senator Brown?
Well, that was part of it. But another thing is that when someone, should someone buy this duplicate, he would not be, that purchaser, I should say, would not be entitled to any prior dividends because it did not have prior ownership to it.
I wasn't talking about prior dividends.
Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to.
Senator Simmons.
I recall normally when you get a duplicate of a sheriff's stock, you have to sign a hold harmless agreement, agreeing to indemnify any lawful holder who comes along anyway.
Well, but this.
But this apparently removes that liability insofar as the state is concerned. So that leaves the original owner then.
The state assumes liability. They would,
the state assumes
liability.
The
purchaser would not indemnify the bona fide.
Senator Wires?
Mr. Chair, what is this amendment dated 313? Do we need to move that as well as the.
No.
Yes.
It's incorporated in the later amendment.
That's. If I might.
Yes, Counselor.
That was an amendment that was proposed at the meeting last week. When I was writing up my staff measure analysis, rather than surprising them with the problems I found, I called ahead of time and I said, oh, by the way, I found these problems.
Excuse me. I just want to know, do we need to move both, or can we just move one?
Just one.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we adopt the amendment dated 319.
All right. That would be a motion in concept. We'll have to run this through Legislative Council, but that's
fine
as far as the form is concerned. But Senator Wires has moved that the amendments of 319-85 be approved by the, adopted by the committee, and that the proper form be sought from Legislative Council. Any discussion on that? Any objection? It's so ordered.
Would you like a motion in concept about the bill?
Yes.
Extending that?
Yes. Senator Wires moves Senate Bill 230 as amended
by the prior motion.
We got the 2-year deal.
No, we got it.
I've taken a look at 231, and I think we can more easily do it in 231.
Oh, okay.
I can still count.
You still got all the roll.
All right. Any discussion? Okay, call a roll, please.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brown? Cohen?
Aye.
Bailey? Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye. Motion passes. Now, we'll take 231.
It's got a brief explanation.
And the council will give us a brief explanation.
In brief.
Oh, this is a new one.
231 repeals the Unclaimed Property Compact. Unclaimed Property Compact is a compact that two other states belong to, other than Oregon. We had testimony to that effect. Wisconsin and New Jersey, apparently. It provides for a way of disposing of property, of unclaimed property, when more than one state claims the property. There are provisions in the Abandoned Property Act that we just got done dealing with that also deal with the disposition of property as between several states. The Division of State Lands testified that one of the reasons for repealing the Unclaimed Property compact, other than the fact that it's not necessary under the current provisions of the law, is the fact that the provisions of the compact do not favor Oregon. The reason that they don't favor Oregon is because when you get to a certain point in the list, it says that if you can't find somebody in this way or that way or the other way, the state gets the property where the business that holds the interest have the largest disbursements. And because Oregon's a small state, we don't generally have the largest disbursements, so some other state's getting the profit. And so they're just saying it's not necessary and it doesn't favor us anyway, and that was the testimony. So they're repealing the whole thing.
Senator Hendrickson.
You know, I was saying, I serve on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee where we're dealing with having to get all these PCBs and hazardous waste, and seeing New Jersey's only one of the other compact states, that's pretty the abandoned property in my opinion. Chair, I would move that we amend Senate Bill 231 to put in, among the other provisions repealed, is 98, is it 418?
418.
All right. Senator Hendrickson moves that Senate Bill 231 be amended in the following respects. Whatever is necessary to change the title from Repeals Unclaimed Property Compact to whatever is necessary to embrace the repeal of this last statute, and on line 2 to add 98.418, and on line 4 to add 98.418. Is that right?
We may have to amend some other statutes, but that's...
And any related statutes.
Yeah, but that's our rules are broad enough to cover the amendment concept.
All right. Any discussion on that? Any objection to Senator Hendrickson's motion? Very well. Senator Hendrickson moves Senate Bill 231 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, subject to the... Yes. Any discussion on that? Call the roll, please.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brown? Cohen?
Aye.
Bailey? Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye. Motion carries. Here we go back to Senate Bill 309. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have we got Jane Gearhart's letter in here somewhere? Where, we did see it, didn't we? I haven't seen it.
I don't believe so.
Need a motion to bring it back into committee, Mr. Chair?
We'll see. Okay, it's not back in here yet, huh?
I don't know. I don't. It seems to me I heard we sent it out. Did we?
We sent it out.
We sent it out on March 5th.
That's where it is right now. Out.
So is it at the desk yet, or
needs to move that we move it back in.
Yeah, we're going to. We'll have to do that. Now, who did you hear that from?
Guy from the village just mentioned it to me. I assumed it was a letter that she sent to you.
Yeah, but
I don't believe I ever saw it.
Well, okay. Let's before we do that, let's hear from Jane Gearhart.
Mr. Chairman,
Council?
Just for the sake of clarity, the reason the bill is back before us is because, if you might remember, the committee passed it out with amendments. One of the amendments was Senator Wires' amendment to delete sections 5, and I believe it was Senator Wires, I may be mistaken, 5 and 7, and in order for the bill to be drafted, well, section 6 had to be deleted as well, and so that additional deletion is back before the committee for approval. That was the original reason it came back.
You say?
I apologize. Could you repeat that? Why did we get it back?
Was I mumbling?
No, I was not tracking or listening.
I believe it was Senator Wires moved to amend the bill to delete sections 5 and 7, which concern board decisions being precedent. In order for the amendment to be complete from a drafting viewpoint, Section 6 needed to be deleted as well, and that's the reason why it's back before the committee now, at least the original reason.
You know, there's a little bit of
Let's take a look here and see what.
What is it that you want?
Well, I want to see if the Senator, what Senator Dwyer's amendment was, or what if he was.
Chair, as I recall, it was an amendment to remove some of the objection to the bill. It wasn't a high priority interest of mine, as I recall from hearing in the discussion in the work session that there was some feeling that if we made that amendment, there'd be less opposition to the bill from the somebody in the state agencies. The council probably remember who.
I'm afraid I don't.
Maybe it was a division, was it?
It was the employment division, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mr. Sager is nodding yes.
Is that nice? Well, it must have been. It might have been 28.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think the issue was, which we've gotten into the Labor Committee somewhat too, is the hearings officials following precedent, you know, all down the line. And I'm sure it got into that. The agency is probably coming from that point of view, I would assume.
It takes out this final order to the final organization. So it still gives the division some control over the decision on the appeal board.
Are you guessing? Do you know for sure what section?
No, that's my notes reflect that Senator Wires moved to delete sections 5 and 7.
Delete sections 5 and 7. Was that the only change in the original bill?
There is also a change, I believe, proposed by Senator Hendrickson to make. Well, I'm not sure about that.
I propose an amendment which Legal Aid offered to require that the members be attorneys.
Right.
Yeah.
That was accepted.
I distinctly remember that. If we weren't considering whether to bring this bill back in committee, I'd like to know how we could send it out to the floor if we don't have any of the amendments before us. Where are they?
I have the amendments right here. And they've been drafted with the additional deletion that I mentioned.
Well, we don't have those. You've got them, but we don't. Is that it?
Yes, exactly.
Well, we don't have Senator Henderson's motion there, do we?
Yes, that's right here.
Okay, online. Okay.
I guess we just don't have the engrossed bill, or if it's been engrossed.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't.
Oh. Well, I think maybe we should. Have you got enough copies of this to hand out to people? I think we should all take a look.
I should have close to enough copies.
Yeah.
I think, though, Mr. Chair, I don't think the amendments affect the question that we have about Section 6.
Okay, is that? I guess what I'm getting at is I want to pinpoint exactly why we're back here taking a look at this thing. It has to do with Section 6 only.
Yeah, just to make it consistent, I think if you take out 5 and 7 and say that you're not going to have any precedent, then you need to take 6 out too, because it talks about declaring precedence. Board of Competence right. Jurisdiction.
Mr. Chairman, the sole reason it was brought back is for drafting consistency. Apparently, and Ms. Gerhardt has had some communications that she wants to make some additional changes. Those aren't the reason it was originally brought back, though.
Well, I did, okay, I'm mixed up then. I thought it was brought back because it's something that Jane Gearhart had communicated about some part of the bill, and...
No.
So then the only thing we're really concerned about is Section 6, right?
Exactly.
And does anybody want to get into anything else at this point in time?
Well,
Senator Wyatt.
I'd like to understand, I'm sorry to slow us up anymore, but I don't quite understand why by deleting 5 and 7 you have to delete 6. In my reading of it, 6 just says if they get reversed by a court of competent jurisdiction, that they have to abide by that. Is there something more there that I don't catch reading it real quickly?
Well, it talks about the precedent.
But if a court, don't we want them to be bound by a court precedent? If the court says you were wrong, the Court of Appeals says you were wrong in this case, don't we want them then to go and tell the spread the word throughout the division, the court has reversed us on a policy direction we were taking, and now we want you to follow the law? We had the testimony that hasn't always been done.
Go ahead, Senator Henderson.
Well, I agree with Senator Wyers. I think we want them to follow that policy, but it looks like to me here, when it talks about declaring invalid a precedent decision of the Board of Appeals, it implies that the Board of Appeals decisions are precedent. And if I thought that in 5 and 7, we took that part out.
Well, the precedent decision of the Employment Group Appeals Board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I hope that they feel bound by the Court of Appeals precedent. But
yeah, I think they would be without even saying it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I'm on board now, so I see why you've got to get 6 out of 10.
The only other thing is, which is not related to this at all, I mean, I have received communication from Pat Randall, who is upset about the attorney provision being applied. I explained to him my reasoning in terms of the arguments, which I found persuasive, about the need to have legally trained people because of the problem with this particular board and in terms of the number of reversals and so forth. But that's simply a policy issue.
Yes. Or in any other discussion, questions, or comments about this now? All right, so we're going to move now to return Senate Bill 309 to the committee. Is that it? Okay. Is there any objection to that motion? So ordered. Now, Senate Bill 309 is before us. And Senator Wyers.
I move that we delete Section 6.
Senator Wyers moves to amend Senate Bill 309. Further amend Senate Bill 309 but delete it by deleting Section 6. Any discussion? Any objection? That's so ordered. Jane Gearhart, were you dying to say something about Section 6 or not?
My request, Mr. Chairman, for the record, should I say I'm Jane Gearhart from Eugene. Chairman Fry, my request was I wish both Section 5 and 6 would be retained because this establishes the board's decisions as precedent for referees. And that subject is not covered in the core bill. And to me, that it's the appellate review, and if it doesn't establish precedent for referees in the division, I see no reason for the expenditure up there. And as I understood the testimony, may I proceed?
Yes, go ahead. Because I think we want to hear why you disagree with us.
I'm sorry to put myself in that position with the committee, but as I understood the testimony of Mr. Sager on the 5th of March, he was objecting because of cost and because of the necessity of establishing a large system to organize the appeals board decisions, but they are already organized by subject and they have a great indexing system, and they're now publishing them to the division and to the referees, so there would be no additional cost involved. And to publish them to the public, it's that could be contracted out and they could recover their dollars on that, it seems to me.
I don't recall, but somebody else might recall, what was the rationale for deleting Section 5?
Mr. Sager's here, maybe you want to find out. I assume it was the division opposition to it.
Yes, come on up, Mr. Sayer.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Sager, Assistant Administrator of Programs with the Employment Division. Yes, we did testify and expressed a concern about those precedent decisions. Bob Oliver, representing the governor, also did express on this particular bill his concern about the precedent decisions. Both of us were, besides the cost issue, which we think there is costs involved with that, we also felt philosophically that the precedent should come from the Court of Appeals where it currently does, and not with a board somewhere between the referees and the Court of Appeals that's in the executive branch. So that was both of our concerns in terms of precedents.
Okay, counsel pointed out that there is a fiscal analysis of this legislation. Is it in our books? Everybody got it? Or just
no, I don't believe it's been included in the books.
Well, anyway, that fiscal analysis indicates essentially what Mr. Sager said, that there's going to be a new financial responsibility here. And I guess that was the reason for their opposition.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm trying to understand the reason, and I guess maybe I wasn't here for that part with Bob Oliver and you testified last time. It would seem that I don't understand the policy reason for not wanting the board to be precedent until they're overturned by the Court of Appeal in terms of consistent decisions within the agency. If the board is the expression of the policy, I don't understand the logic of, because there would be precedent unless they were overturned by the Court of Appeals. I mean, if you have the board's decisions as precedential as far as binding on the hearings officers, then you would have uniformity with respect to policy. I don't understand why that isn't considered desirable by the agency.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hendrickson, the way it's been expressed to me is that the Employment Appeals Board has been described as a lay board to try to provide an intermediate step outside of the control of the administrator, if you will, outside of the agency to review unemployment cases. And they seem to do a pretty good job on those cases that is deciding for a claimant or an employer whether they do collect benefits. As legal aid, I guess.